The third reset could be a reset around what I and others call a mega region, which is really a grouping of metropolitan areas, a grouping of cities and suburbs, like the Great Boston, New York, Washington corridor.
Right.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. Today we're talking with Richard Florida, author most recently of The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. Richard, thanks for coming.
Oh, man, it's great to be here.
You say that we're in the midst of a third great reset. The first was the Long Depression of the 1870s. The second was the Great Depression of the 1930s. The first reset gave rise to kind of centralized cities. Mm-hmm. The Great Depression or the second reset gave rise to suburbia. What's the third reset and what is it giving rise to?
What was interesting for me in having some time to look back at the history of periods of crisis and transformation is really that, you know, we call them depressions and recessions. We focus on the hardship and the despair. And we tend to think of these periods where government comes in and transforms the economy, at least in our modern memory. And that may or may not play a role. We can talk more about that. But what I found is two things really matter. One, which Joseph Schumpeter pointed out a long time ago, these are periods of tremendous creative destruction, but not just of individual innovations. And I track the history looking at great studies. They're systems of innovation that cluster and come together. But the second thing I found is they transform our economic geography in ways that most of us don't consider to be important, and that these massive shifts in the way we live and work and kind of organize our cities and then our suburbs are really the thing which propel economic growth. I've taken a call of it a real geographic Keynesianism, and the best example is that the rise of suburbanization. You know, obviously, there was government spending in the New Deal, there was World War II mobilization, there was a period of rapid innovation, but in my view, this suburban phenomenon, the creation of a market for suburban houses has really stoked the industrial machine, creating demand for autos
and that's something that's much larger than certainly any government policy. But I mean, it really takes it takes over and transforms the economy and is transformed by the
economy. I think the part of government policy that worked was the part, and I'm not saying it's relevant for today either.
Right.
For its time, the part that worked was infrastructure enabling that created markets.
Is it also always the case that starting in the 1870s, Americans started moving in, immigrants started moving to urban areas? It's about 1920 when a majority of people are living in cities.
Yes, absolutely.
Right at the moment, then suburbanization really starts, kicks in after World War II. What a plurality of Americans are in suburbs since about 2000. And now you're essentially arguing that that model is over and we're shifting into something else.
Yeah, and I say in the book, you know, I'm not a clairvoyant and I don't have any crystal ball. It'd be like trying to predict post-war America from the vantage point of the election of 1932. But there are certain trends and tendencies in our economy and society that augur for a next kind of reset and what geographers call a spatial fix. So one of the things I point out is I think it's a false distinction we make, and we're trapped mm-hmm. by it, between city and suburb, or
right.
maybe the battle between the area codes, the bridges
right.
and the tunnels.
Right.
And what I seem to find, looking back at the history of American capitalism, is that one of the driving forces is the simultaneous intensification of the use of space, perhaps at the core in the city, and the expanded use of space or geography. So what I argue in the book is if the first reset was the reset of urban America and big industrial cities, the second reset was the reset of metropolitan America and the city and its expanded territory, the suburb. The third reset could be a reset around what I and others call a mega region, which is really a grouping of metropolitan areas, a grouping of cities and suburbs, like the Great Boston, New York, Washington corridor.
Right. Yeah. You talk in the book about connecting, and you would say the answer is high-speed rail.
One of the things I learned in studying resets is that the best and most appropriate role of government is enabling infrastructure that enables markets to develop. So the investments in electric power, the investment, Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse, the investments in cable cars and subway systems and street rails enabled the development in and around that industrial city. The investment in highways, and we could debate whether those were good investments
right.
or not. The interstate highway system enabled suburbia.
Talk about high-speed rail, because this is on the table. It's part of an Obama administration initiative to keep up with China, was one of the arguments that he made. But high-speed rail, there's only about two lines in the world that have repaid their capital
Absolutely.
Costs, all operate at heavy subsidies. Intercity highways, intercity air travel all pay for their own freight through user fees. Why wouldn't we just build more roads or more toll roads or revamp the air travel system?
First of all, absolutely, I say this in the book, price the damn roads. Right. I mean, to give away that valuable space when people pay for everything else. So one thing we have to do is ease congestion and speed. I talk about this in the book, the velocity of moving people, goods, and ideas. But it seems to me the only way we can effectively stretch the boundaries of our urban space is by achieving a faster kind of rail travel. And so my hunch is that kind of subsidy makes sense. I agree with you. I'm not sure it will pay for itself. And Ed Glaser and others have done nice cost-benefit analysis. But my hunch is
most of which come out, I mean, and I don't want to say just because I agree with them, but the more serious ones that really do a full accounting is that it's going to be like Amtrak, where the average fare is subsidized $50 a ticket or something
like that. And you would hope, one would hope, that that level of subsidy would encourage development and the increase of density along the corridor that would increase productivity and pay for itself. But I do think we're looking at a subsidy. My own hunch is if we're going to help cities like Cleveland or Buffalo or St. Louis, I say this in the book, it's probably the best helping hand we can give them to connect them to Chicago. But I agree with you, Nick, and I've been criticized for this. I do think it means connecting them to bigger hub cities, which are going to be the employment options. And you and I were talking about this. You were saying in some of these cities, the best option is to have work elsewhere. And people take me to task for this, but I think this is true. I think that that will enable people in Pittsburgh or Detroit to connect to bigger employment centers and make them, in effect, suburbs. I do think that what happened in the Northeast Corridor is instructive. You know, when I was growing up, when we were growing up in New Jersey, they were suburbs of New York. I really do believe that Washington, D.C., and its renaissance is not just a legacy of federal spending and all of this and that, but it has become more integrated into this large megalopolis.
Well, and there's no question. I mean, during the post-war era, certainly the 60s, 70s, 80s, the corporate headquarters moved into New Jersey. They moved to Connecticut, Westchester, in a way that they hadn't been before. So, I mean, there was a kind of bleeding out. You talk about the housing bubble, you know, and everybody recognizes that that was at the center of the current financial crisis, which is part and parcel of this great reset. The government's been trying to jack up home ownership rates since at least the Hoover administration. What went wrong, and why is home ownership, by your lights, not such a great idea?
Well, I think home ownership played a fabulous role in the post-war boom. I mean, and the way it happened is it really stoked it, geographic Keynesianism. It really stoked the demand for those houses, and, not only houses, but cars and refrigerators and appliances coming off the assembly line. What I think happened is as we were growing this new knowledge-based and creative and idea-driven economy, we're doing a pretty darn good job of growing it up until the bubble popped. And I think when the tech bubble popped, people said, well, what am I going to do with this capital that's sloshing around? Oh, I'll put it in bricks and mortar. So this kind of perverse thing happened. And instead of investing in productivity, we began to slosh over tons of this productivity gains and wealth gains. And we had not only a housing bubble, we had tremendous land inflation. So I think the bubble became pernicious. And what I'm arguing for is not the end of home ownership. What I found in a little empirical study I did was that the places that tend to adjust the best to the economic shocks, that are most resilient, that have high rates of innovation and business formation, have about 55% of their people being homeowners. Now, in the U.S., it's about 67%. The Urban Land Institute predicts it's going to come down to 62%. And if you look at the analysis of the underwater mortgages, people are already saying, when people have no equity, we're already down to 60. So I'm talking about dialing back home ownership. And if you have a secure job, if you want to live in a place for a long time, for sure, buy your house.
Well,
but if not,
and
be careful.
You talk about how renting, say, or an alternative to home ownership allows people to be more mobile, which also means that economies are more fluid and can adapt more easily to change circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that's the great success story. You know, my view of America is what made America great was mobility, the ability to absorb outsiders coming here for economic opportunity and personal freedom, and the ability for people to move around this country in a way that no other country that I've seen can handle it. So I think that now the home ownership is kind of limited mobility, and we have the lowest rates of mobility since we've tracked it. So we got to get our mobility back. And I think the other thing is that we have so much surplus housing. And, you know, the administration is trying to incentivize people to go back and refinance their home. That's proving to be a disaster. One of the ideas I have is why not turn that surplus housing, those foreclosed homes, those empty condos into affordable rental? And I noticed in Miami Beach, of all places, the Miami Beach Community Development Corporation is buying up some of those condo projects and creating affordable rental for service workers. That seems to be a sensible thing to do today.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Richard Florida, author most recently of The Great Reset, for talking with Reason TV today. I'm Nick Gillespie.